What's the bravest thing that you've ever done? What's the bravest thing you've ever done? I've mentioned probably a couple of things before, which I won't go into again. But for me, some of the brave things I think I've done is to do a quite a high up Tarzan swing in a high ropes course in the Trossachs in Scotland. Another brave thing would be catching a long distance train out of Delhi, just Helen and me, to somewhere that we'd never been. Another brave thing, maybe. Sometimes Roy says to me that I do things that push him outside of his comfort zone. And so going door to door, knocking on the doors. We've done that a couple of times before Super Sundays, and Jill came and joined in last time, which was another really brave thing to do. But knocking on people's doors to invite them to Super Sundays, that's quite a brave thing to do, I think. Do you want to see Helen doing a brave thing? Do you want to see Helen wrestling a crocodile? Helen wrestling a crocodile. Are you ready for this? There she is. There's the crocodile. Don't ask me why she's kissing its bottom. I don't know. I think she got confused which was the head. But anyway, so there's Helen wrestling a crocodile. But I think probably for many of us, speaking up is not something we find very easy. And particularly if you're a Christian, speaking up then for Jesus takes a fair amount of bravery, a fair amount of courage. I remember in university in my first year, can't remember what we were looking at, but we had this tutor, professor by the name of Neville Morley, and he had a very small mouth. He had a mouth that was like this. And he talked quite like this as well. I can't remember what we were looking at, but he came out with this line about how in the Bible, the Apostle Paul was a misogynist. If you don't want to know what a misogynist means, it basically means you hate women. It's like chauvinism, but it's worse. It actually means that you think it's your job to set out to make women's life a misery and to use women as you choose. So this is what he said about Paul. And me being not really knowing how to handle this, I remember objecting in my lecture, putting my hand up and speaking out against that. And it really wound me up. I don't think I handled it very well, because I just tried to talk, whereas I think it would have been better if I'd said something like, "That's a really interesting and harsh generalization. Can you tell me what you mean by that?" And asked him to put himself on the spot and explain what he means. Because people do make these kinds of generalizations, don't they, about Christianity. You know, oh, the Bible's just a fairy tale, is it? How did you come to that conclusion? Jesus never really existed, didn't he? How did you decide that? What's the evidence for that? Oh, I don't know. Bible's full of contradictions, is it? Like one. Like, mention one. Name one. So, anyway, but speaking up for Jesus is hard, isn't it? And, you know, my knees aren't quite knocking normally because I was sitting down. But, you know, that kind of thing, your heart beats and everything. And it's really tough speaking up for Jesus. And you might find that in your place of work. You might find that amongst your friends or your relatives, where someone says something that's really critical of Jesus. So today's message from Esther is really, I guess, an encouragement for you. If, like me, you've ever found like you feel like you've lost your voice, when that moment comes and you feel like you want to speak out for Jesus and you feel like you've lost your voice. Or when that moment comes and you just feel like somewhere in here I need to say something, but you just don't quite know when it is. And today's message is for you, to encourage you. We're looking at Esther today. And it can be that when we look at the book of Esther, we kind of have this idea of her being a kind of fairy tale queen. You know, here's Grace Kelly marrying Prince Rainier of Monaco, and 1956, you know, fairy tale wedding, totally lavish, you know. I could have perhaps chosen one of the more recent British royal weddings. But a fairy tale. Here she is, Esther. She's a nobody, yet she gets catapulted to being queen of Persia. And, you know, she's marrying King Xerxes, and Xerxes is the most powerful king in the known world. He was king from 486 to 465 BC. The kingdom of Persia, or the empire of Persia, I should call it, it covered 127 provinces. That's a lot of provinces, whatever that means. But it's a lot of places. I read that it stretched their empire, and we'll come back to the empire, but it stretched for 1,000,000 square miles. 1,000 miles in each direction. Huge, huge area. But the reality isn't quite the fairy tale queen. It's a little bit more like this. It's kind of a pitiable prize. There's no romance. It's clinical and it's cold. It's the story of a systematic, enforced selection of the most beautiful young girls in the empire in order not to be queen, but to enter the king's harem of an untold number of wives or women. These are all girls. They're all teens. They're all pre-marriage, yeah? It's like some kind of forced audition for the X Factor. You know, where you're at the end, you get added to Simon Cowell's list of wonderful, talented people. And these girls, they'd be groomed for 12 months with beauty treatments. If you have a Bible, you'd be able to see this in Esther chapter 2 and verse 12. They get these beauty treatments for 12 months. We tend these days to use the word grooming in a very particular sense as well, don't we? Talking about grooming children and things. And I think it was very much like that. I don't believe that a young Jewish girl's greatest dream is to end up in the king's harem. So they were being groomed, they were being prepared for the one night with the king. The word that they use often in the Bible for this type of a wife is concubine. It's kind of a second-rate wife. Legally, you're a wife. In terms of relationship, not really. You're just there for the king's pleasure. You're maybe there to provide an heir. That's about it. And so we have this this verse. I think the NLT puts it really well. The Bible that we've got here puts it really well. The end of verse 14 in chapter 2. It says, that evening, the girl would be taken to the king's private rooms, and the next morning she was brought to the second harem where the king's wives lived. There she would be under the care of this eunuch who was in charge of all the concubines. She would never go to the king again unless he'd especially enjoyed her and requested her by name. So it could all be for just one night. And your entire purpose is to give pleasure to the king. But within this, there was a prize. A pitiable prize, yes, but there was a prize, and that was the faint hope of being made queen. If you like, the true wife of Xerxes. You would have more freedom, you'd have more importance, you'd have more entitlement. It would be more like a regular marriage, perhaps. And it turned out that the winner of this prize was Esther. Now, these girls came from all over the empire. they were sent to look for wives, for women, for girls, for the king from every province, all 127 of them. And the winner was Esther. We're told in verse 17 of chapter 2 that the king loved Esther more than any of the other young women, and he was so delighted with her that he set the royal crown on her head. And he throws a banquet in her honour. Esther is a young Jewish girl, but under Mordecai, her uncle's advice, not her uncle, her cousin's advice, she keeps her nationality a secret for now. So Esther's Jewish. How does a Jewish girl end up being ruled over by King Xerxes of Persia? Last week we looked at Hannah. Do you remember looking at Hannah? And we're looking at the birth of Samuel. Samuel is the last of the judges of Israel. And then we have this period of the kings of Israel. Great kings like Saul and David and Solomon. But since the days of Hannah, 600 years have passed. It's the biggest difference, obviously, is today in the early 1400s. It's a huge difference in terms of time. And Israel has these great kings. But eventually, due to the spiritual disobedience of the kings and the people, the breaking down of that relationship with God where he'd chosen them, God handed them as a nation over to their enemies. And so in 586, Jerusalem fell, was conquered by the Babylonians, and the people were taken captive, and their king was executed. But in 538 BC, so that's about 50 years later, the Persians come along and they overcome the Babylonians. So here's what I was talking about when I was talking about the Persian Empire. That's Susa there, that's the capital, that's the place that gets mentioned in the story lots. Here's Judea, here's Jerusalem down here. Okay? So all of this region now, all of this, look, there's India, this is kind of Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, Turkey, Greece, Macedonia, up into the edge of Bulgaria there, Egypt, Syria, all these places, all under the rule of Xerxes. It's a huge place. So Esther is found. Esther's real name is Hadassah. And Hadassah means myrtle, a lovely, beautiful, delicate flower. Esther, I don't know if it's a nickname, but it's basically the name of this Persian goddess, the goddess of love, called Ishtar. She's an orphan. She's raised by her older cousin Mordecai. Mordecai, incidentally, that's not a Jewish name either. That comes from the Babylonian god's name of Marduk. Don't know if he had a Jewish name as well. But you can see what people thought. Oh, what have I done there? You can see what people thought of Esther. That she was destined to be this love goddess. That's what she was about. They couldn't see her as a beautiful, delicate flower anymore. They had to see her as a love goddess. Anyway. So her name, Mordecai's name, being subject to this foreign power called Persia, being away from home because, you know, the Babylonians came in, destroyed Jerusalem, they took all the people away, all of this. the Jews are at risk of losing their identity. One of the puzzling facts about the book of Esther is that God is never mentioned. How can you have a book of the Bible in which God is never mentioned? Are they losing their identity as God's people? What will God do in the situation that they're about to face? See, there's a feud that's developed between Mordecai and Xerxes' chief of staff, a guy called Haman. And it's a feud which puts the whole Jewish nation at rest. Haman has tricked Xerxes into allowing him to publish a law giving permission for all the Jews to be annihilated because of his personal feud with Mordecai. They've set a date for it. The date is March the 7th, 473 BC. And when I say all Jews being annihilated, I mean not just in Susa, in the capital, but in every province of the entire empire. This is, if you like, the first attempt at a Jewish Holocaust. The picture here, last autumn I went to stay with a friend of mine in Hungary, on the banks of the Danube, I think it is, isn't it? Flows through the middle of Budapest, is a Jewish memorial, and it's simply a line of shoes made out of iron, so they survive the elements, but a line of shoes, empty shoes, because when the Nazis arrived in Hungary, they took the Jews, they made them take off their shoes as they stood at the edge of the river. Then they shot them all and let the bodies fall in and the river carry them away. It's quite shocking, isn't it? But it's right there. It is literally a stone's throw from the Hungarian parliament. I don't know what Haman was imagining, how that might happen, getting rid of the Jews. But it's his first attempt. That's what the reference was. Where is it? In verse 8, it says, Mordecai giving Hathach a copy of a decree issued in Susa that called for the death of all the Jews. So it is the first attempt at a Jewish Holocaust. But what Haman doesn't know is that there is, as they say, an ace in the hole. We join the story at the point where Mordecai and the other Jews throughout the empire learn of the law that Haman's published. Everyone knows about it apart from Esther. She's locked up in the palace. That is her place. She doesn't go out. She doesn't get to hear the laws. She's separated by the palace walls. And Mordecai has to explain the whole situation to her through this messenger called Hathach. He wants her to go to the king to beg for mercy, to plead for her people. That's verse 8 of chapter 4. But if she just walks in on the king without being summoned, she's going to be executed. Look, everyone knows this, she says. She says she hasn't seen the king for a month. How does the king feel about me right now? I don't know, because I've not seen him in a month. Has he gone off me? What's he going to think when he sees me? It's that kind of question which is going through her mind. And then Mordecai gives her this challenge. You can see it in verses 13 and 14. Don't think for a moment that because you're in the palace, you'll escape when all other Jews are killed. If you keep quiet at a time like this, deliverance and relief for the Jews will arise from some other place, but you and your relatives will die. Who knows if perhaps you were made for queen for just such a time as this? In this odd book in which God is not mentioned, God is always there in the background. His warning, Mordecai's warning to Esther is, don't think you're going to escape this, because you won't. But then he makes these points as well. Firstly, God will save us whether you help us or not. How will deliverance and relief arise for the Jews? Well, if you keep quiet, it's going to come from somewhere else. Mordecai is absolutely convinced that God's going to deliver these people, with or without Esther's help. And then he says this as well. Perhaps this is what God has made you queen for. That this whole thing that you went through, where you were taken from us effectively to be forced to join the king's harem, and actually you wound up getting the top prize. Maybe God has chosen you for this moment, for this thing. And Esther's reply is just as full of God. Firstly, she tells them, fast for me. Why fast? Because fasting is a form of prayer, isn't it? It's a form of desperate prayer, you might say. This situation is so grave, we've got to fast. It's the expectation that God can change the situation around. Then she says, hey, not just you guys fast, we're going to fast as well. And this I find quite fascinating. She says, my maids and I will do the same. My maids and I will fast as well. Were they Jews? I don't know. But I assume so on the basis of what she said. And yet they were appointed to her when she joined the harem to look after her. So how did they become Jews? Has Esther already shared about Yahweh with them? I just find that really strange. Or really wonderful. And then she says, look, I will go in. Even if I must die, I will go. She shows this bravery and this courage. I'm going to do it. 3 days' time, that's the plan. You fast, I'll go. 3 days' time. And our reading today ends at that point where Esther is invited in to see King Xerxes. She's hanging around. It's like she's, I don't know, maybe there's some kind of doorway and she's kind of, and he just spots her through that doorway and he calls her in. And he calls her in actually with these wonderful words. And this is the verse immediately after the one which... where I stopped. The king asked her, what do you want, Queen Esther? What's your request? I will give it to you, even if it's half the kingdom. So if you want to know exactly how the story goes on, you'll have to read it. But suffice to say that she does speak up for her people in front of the king, and thereby rescue them from this guy Haman and this Holocaust that would have come. She delivers crucial intervention in that situation. There is no one else who had that opportunity, no one else who had that place, no one else who had the ear of the king like she might have done in this. She's mediating in that. She's being a go-between. She's going between Mordecai and the people and the king. And in doing so, she establishes a fascinating pattern. Oh, that's nice, isn't it? Lots of extra lights on the screen. But look, there's four people here. There's a king, a people, an enemy, and a mediator. There's Xerxes, the king. He's the one with all the authority. There's the people, the Jews. They're the ones in danger. Then there's the enemy, Haman. He's the one who's trying to get them all killed. And then there's a mediator, Esther, who steps up, speaks to the king on behalf of the people, and they're saved. But that, it really, to me, that's a pattern of what we see in the gospel. We have a king, the great king, God, who is king above all gods. We have a world which is in danger. Because we have an enemy called Satan, who's dragging us into death and destruction. And we have a mediator called Christ, who goes before God and he rescues us. The Apostle Paul puts it like this in a letter to Timothy. He says, there's one God and one mediator who can reconcile God and humanity, the man Christ Jesus. He gave his life to purchase freedom for everyone. We have God and we have humanity. How do we bridge that gap? When God is so holy and humanity is so sinful, we need a man who is also God. We need a Jesus, the Son of God. And where for Esther, she didn't need to give her life, yet it's a picture of what's going to happen. That Jesus, it is going to take him giving his life in order to purchase freedom for us. God raised him from the dead. Let's not be in any doubt about that. But it took Jesus giving his life. We are in danger. And Jesus comes and mediates and rescues us. We talk about an extraordinary Esther doing this extraordinary thing before the greatest king in the known world. Here is extraordinary Jesus doing something even more extraordinary before the great king of the universe. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14 says this: only as a human being could he die, and only by dying could he break the power of the devil who had the power of death. So wherever you are this morning, you need to know this, that without Jesus, we're doomed to destruction. We're like the Jews in this story. We have an enemy who wants to destroy us. We have an enemy who wants to keep us away from Jesus, the one who loved us and gave himself for us. But with Jesus as mediator, with faith in him, you're going to be rescued. You're not going to perish. Isn't that great? Another, this bit about Esther and for such a time as this, was this the right time? Maybe you were born queen just for this particular reason. You know, again, the Apostle Paul writes to the Galatians, I think it is, at just the right time Christ died. He was born into the world. Born of a woman, born under law. For our salvation, for us to be rescued. The right time, the right person at the right time. Yesterday was my birthday. Thank you very much. So we had the day out. Went somewhere I'd not heard of before and not been to before, obviously. We went to a safari park in Liverpool, and we had a great drive around through. Apparently, it's the longest safari drive you can do in UK. It's 5 miles long, great getting up close with rhinos and. Well, the lions were being fed, so I think they brought them into a cage at that point. So it was a bit disappointing that they weren't free roaming. But the baboons and camels and bison and, you know, all this kind of jazz. It was great. And then, of course, there's a normal kind of zoo bit as well that you can walk around. One of the things which we wanted to do, and as soon as Kieran saw it on the map, he was like, I want to do that, was a bat cave. Not the bat cave, because that's secret. No one knows where the real bat cave is. But no, this bat cave. So you go in the building, and there's just bats free to fly around. Only we went in, it seems, at feeding time or something, because when we went in there, it was absolutely crazy. There must have been 100 bats, maybe more, flying around, I'm not kidding, like this, in this circle. About, you know, and that, you had to walk around the circle, around some rock and tree thing in the middle, right? You followed the path around and come out again. And they were doing the same loop, but in all kinds of different directions and angles. I definitely felt one brushing the back of my head, felt another one just in the middle of my forehead about there. It was not a pleasant experience for me, personally. When I go in these kinds of places, I kind of feel like I'm sticking out and that I'm more of a target. I don't know if someone like Brian feels the same, So I was kind of, there was a guy holding a toddler in front of me in his arms. So I was kind of staying close to him and I was bending over a bit like this, trying to duck all these bats are going like this. And the kids loved it, by the way. They went in for a second turn later on, but apparently it was much, much quieter. Anyway, and the woman said, don't bend over, because if you jerk up, you're going to hit one. It's like, I'm not planning on jerking up. I'll just go even lower. I'll crawl if I have to. But anyway. It struck me that with faith in Jesus, there is an issue of bravery. There's an issue of courage. Because we're talking about faith. We're talking about something which, as convinced as I am about it, and as convinced as I know so many of you are about it, is not provable. Not in the way in which the world loves to talk about provable. And so faith is a risk. It takes a risk. It takes being brave to actually make that decision to start trusting Jesus. I wonder if today you're going to be brave enough to make that kind of decision for the first time, to trust Jesus. Jesus was killed because of what he did and because of the words that he spoke. He made great claims about himself. He said great things about God, but which went very much against the grain of what people were hearing at the time, and the religious establishment didn't like it. For us to speak out for God takes the same kind of bravery. So where does that come from? I would say that the New Testament is fairly clear on the idea that this kind of boldness comes through the Holy Spirit. Jesus, at one point, talks about how he talks about being put on trial. He was telling the disciples, hey, this is going to happen to you. But he's talking about being put on trial and said, when you're in that situation, the Holy Spirit will give you the words to say. Mark 13, verse 11. And then as another example, the disciples gathering together. After they face some opposition, some persecution, the disciples gathering together in Acts chapter 4. And they prayed for God to enable his servants to speak the gospel with great boldness. And we're told that's what happened. Because as they were praying, the place shook. And they were filled with that boldness. And they went out speaking about Jesus. Our strapline as a church, and you'll find it on the front of the welcome sheet, is holding on to Jesus, holding out his love. We're very good at the holding on to Jesus bit. Are we so good at the holding out his love bit? The disciples had no issue with seeking the Lord for greater boldness and greater bravery. Maybe we should be doing the same. A couple of months ago, when I went on the Rural Ministries National Conference, the guy that was speaking talked about how... Oh, he was talking about evangelism. He was talking about mission. And he said, 70% of Christians, 7 in 10 Christians, know a non-Christian who they could invite to something, maybe invite along on a Sunday, that kind of thing. Isn't that great? Isn't that fantastic? Bit of a shame that 3 in 10 of us don't know any non-Christians, but there we go. But then he added this. The same research showed that an average of 90% never intend to actually do that. 90% of that 7% never intend to invite anybody to anything. I don't know why that is. I've struggled myself in times past with inviting people to things. Would I invite people to regular church? I don't know. Would you? Is it too much of a risk? That I'm going to be long-winded as usual and stuff like that? Would I invite somebody to Super Sunday? Do you know, the other week, I think it was the one at the end of May, it was really fantastic. Jo's not here this morning, so I can praise her without her getting embarrassed. But she'd invited... her husband, she'd invited another mum that she knew with a kid, she'd also got in contact with the Syrian family, Bob and Myrna, and Myrna and the children, and she'd gone to Myrna's house to meet her and bring her down with them. She had a table full of people she'd brought on her own. It was so exciting and so wonderful. Did she do anything special? Not really. She just invited people. Now, when you invite, you can't guarantee what the response is going to be. I know that. But I just want to encourage you to think of being a little bit more brave, maybe. Who can you invite? Who would you invite? If Super Sunday's not your cup of tea, that's fine. But what are you going to invite people to? Jesus mediated between us and God. He did it for eternity. He did it wonderfully. But now we're in Christ. He is not here in his bodily form. But we are here and we're doing the same thing. We have a world out there which is lost, which is heading for destruction. It's our job to do the holding out. It's our job to do the mediating. It's our job to do the intervening and the intercessing and everything else. Let's be brave like Esther and be extraordinary.